सहनावतु सहनौघुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्युषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Repeat after me. We'll start at the beginning verse. Vasudevendra yogindram, Vasudevendra yogindram, Natvajnana pradang gurum, Natvajnana pradang gurum, Mumukshunam hitarthaya, Tattvabodho vidhiyate. Vabodho. Last class, I left us with a cliffhanger. I don't know if you know what a cliffhanger is. A cliffhanger is, I guess, in the old radio, I guess it started in the radio days where you'd have a story, a serial, where every week or every a couple times a week there would be a new episode. And to get people to tune in the next week, there would be a cliffhanger. There'd be some suspenseful event that happens that you just need to tune in the next week so that you can see what happens. And often, the cliche was that somebody, like an old Western radio show or even early days of movies, they would have these small serials, these black and white little stories. And at the end of a particular episode, the hero or heroine would be dangling by their fingernails off a cliff. And they call them cliffhangers because you wanted to see if the hero would fall down to his doom into the deep valley below, or if he would be rescued, and invariably the hero of the story is always rescued. So I left you last time with a cliffhanger. Kaha Atma, Atma Kaha. Who is this Atma? And we'd covered a lot of territory up to that point. And I'd also given you some homework, which some of you may have remembered. It was to pay attention during the course of the day as to where the I thought lands. And we'll talk more about that in a moment because we are constantly defining ourselves by incidental criteria. This I notion is a rascal and it seems to land everywhere but where it properly belongs. And what I mean by properly belongs, it seems to land everywhere except on my true nature. And we'll see that in a moment. But at the very beginning of this text, the first sentence is Sadhana Chatushtaya Sampannadikarinam Moksha Sadhana Bhutam Tattva Viveka Prakaram Vakshyamaha. He says, we're going to talk about this method for discerning the truth, the reality, really what is, really what is. And that is the moksha sadhana bhutam. That is the means for freedom. For whom? The sadhana chatushtaya sambhanadikarinam. For those who are qualified, those who have the fourfold wealth, the fourfold characteristics of a serious student, and one who has the capacity to really hear and listen to what is being said. Now, it's really beautiful that this text talks in detail about these qualities. It doesn't tell you how to get them, unfortunately, but it does state what they are. And it's so important, but many of the other texts just allude to this. For example, the Kaivalya Upanishad, it just says, Atta, Atta, Atashvalayanaha. This sage goes to Brahma and asks for Brahma Vidya. And with the very first word of the text is Atta. Atta just means now or thereafter. Atta. And what it means is after gaining these qualities. Now, if there were such a person in this world who had all of these qualities in absolute measure, they would be called an Uttama Adhikari, a one who is a perfectly qualified student who could hear this teaching, Tattvamasi, you in your true nature are the truth of this entire creation and everything you search for in all of your pursuits. They could hear that and in a moment see it and be mukta purusha, be free just at that moment. There is no such person. And these qualities are never gained in full measure because the world is imperfect. And this manifestation as an individual is imperfect. We'll never have these to full measure. But if we have them to a relative degree, and to the degree we have them, to that degree this teaching is clear, until there's such a preponderance of the clarity of this knowledge that this knowledge is very clear, regardless of the perfection one may experience vis-a-vis these qualities. So that's to say that these qualities are very important, because without these, the teaching is just academic, and the teaching just doesn't come to life, and the teaching doesn't pertain to me, and the teaching is filled with vagueness and uncertainties and doubts and errors. So they're very important qualities. And just very briefly, these qualities are viveka, vairagya, shatka sampattihi, and mumukshutvam. So viveka is discrimination, nitya nitya vastu vivekaha, the discrimination between what is nitya and what is anitya, what is eternal and what is not. And at the stage, we're just people who are curious. We have a sense, a need, a seeking, a spiritual bent. We know that there's more to this life than what television commercials are telling us. And we're seekers. So we really don't have, I mean, to really know what is nitya, what actually truly exists that is free from time, is jumping the gun a little bit here. What this nitya nitya vastu vivekaha is this discernment that there is something more than what I have been gleaning from these new experiences, these new objects, these new relationships that I keep trying to bring into my life to fill this void. And it's like building a house on sand. It just keeps sinking, and I just have to keep feeding more and more and more and more. And pretty soon, or finally, if we're blessed with a little discernment, we think, these things all come and go, and yet I get a little hit of happiness. I get a little contentment. I know that there's more, and I know there has to be a better way to get this. And so that's when we started to look at what's called purushartha vichara, purushartha viveka. We saw that the pursuit of kama, the pursuit of artha, the pursuit of even dharma, the pursuit of enjoyable objects and experiences, the pursuit of security, of wealth, of power, of money, and even the pursuit of heaven, if we believe in heaven, even the pursuit of trying to create a more joyful afterlife, are fleeting and really don't solve the fundamental universal human problem, is that I take myself to be a lacking, mortal, imperfect, wanting being, and I seem to always be left wanting. And so this is called purushartha vichara, this discernment. Purushartha is something that is naturally pursued by all people. And these are things that we all pursue. We all want an enjoyable life. We all want security. We all want a greater good, dharma, if you will. But all these don't seem to solve this equation. As I talked about in a different talk, in India, I was so blessed to be asked by Shankar. He arranged a talk at a temple in Chennai. And the idea behind the talk was, we're all trying to solve this equation, I plus X equals happiness. I plus X equals security. And that X is a variable. And we try to plug in all sorts of values for that variable. We try to plug in all sorts of values for that variable X. And none of them seem to work. They all fall short. Because there's nothing I can add to myself and nothing I can subtract even from myself that will get me what it is that I know is a deeper meaning to my pursuits, what it is I'm really searching for in my pursuits. So this nitya nitya vastu vivekaha, this viveka, this discernment that I need to place my attention on what really matters, because life is ticking away. And before you know it, you know, we may not have the ability, the concentration, the body may not be able to give us the focus that we need to do what it is we need to do to solve the spiritual question, this burning question. And that gives us some vairagya. That gives us the second quality, which is I have a natural objectivity towards the capacity to sense objects and to wealth and to all these things that we normally pursue. And we have some objectivity and realize they're not going to solve this fundamental problem. No value of X is going to make me a full, happy, complete person, because all values of X are time-bound. All values of X are limited. All values of X never seem to solve the problem, and yet I find myself happy at some time. I find myself happy for no reason. I find myself happy in spite of having hundreds of unfulfilled desires. I find myself happy for no reason at all. So really the relationship between the pursuit of objects of happiness, of objects of security, and my sense of security and my sense of happiness, there's a very questionable relationship at best between those. Because if I can be happy without the fulfillment of a particular desire, and if I could be happy with hundreds of outstanding desires, then really, what do these pursuits that I'm normally spending my time doing, what do they have to do with me becoming happy, with me being happy? Maybe the equation is flawed. Maybe it's not I plus X equals happiness. So that's when we come to a teaching. If we're lucky and we're blessed, we come to a teaching that says, it's not you plus X equals what it is you seek. The teaching says you are what it is you seek. Oh, wow. That's quite a blessing just to have that information. And in some cultures, it's part of the culture that there is this idea that there is a well-known set of spiritual practices, spiritual teachers, spiritual texts, wherein people have seen this and are teaching this. Other of us have to seek pretty hard if we come from other cultures. And yet, in all cultures, there is this idea that the spiritual pursuits will eventually lead to what it is that we're actually seeking. So there are these sixfold qualities, this third set of qualifications that we want to nurture to help us appreciate what it is we're going to learn. And these are shama, dhamma, upariti, titiksha, shraddha, samadhanam. So just very briefly, shama, the ability to have a choice as to how the mind functions, how the mind responds to situations. Dhamma, an ability to have a choice regarding how we respond to situations. So shama is a quietude of mind, and if we don't have a quietude of mind, we have at least the dhamma, we have the ability to not act out in ways that are not in keeping with my value system, not in keeping with dharma. And they're really tools to help us look at our reactivity to the way we think things should be, to the models we have around the world, about the world, and our attachment to the way we think things should be. In other words, when we have an emotional reaction to the world, it's because it's not behaving the way I think it should be, because I think I have something at stake in the world, and it has to be a certain way for me to be okay. For me to be happy and at home, I need the world to fulfill a certain plan. People need to fill certain roles. People need to give me certain things, and people need to not do other things towards me. And if that doesn't happen, I get agitated. And that agitation shows that I have some work to do vis-a-vis shama. Because if I really offered no resistance to how things are unfolding at every moment, shama would be a natural quality. All of these qualities are natural to jnani, to the one who knows oneself and knows the truth. And for others of us, it is our sadhana. It's our spiritual practice. So when we see that emotional, that reactivity, there are a number of ways to deal with it. We've talked about that in other classes. And dhamma is one very concrete way to deal with the lack of shama. And dhamma is the choice where if someone comes up, as I mentioned before, and says, you're ugly and your mother dresses you funny, we don't go off and hit them. That's a very crude example of dhamma. Shama dhamma upariti. Upariti is doing one's own dharma, doing what the creation is calling us to do. It can also be seen as sannyasa, being either an internal or an external renunciation. Basically what it is aligning our life, our actions, our attention to our value system, and to creating harmony with the world. So it can be seen as a reduction of unnecessary activities, because all I really want is freedom. All I really want is moksha. And so I don't need to be distracted by all pursuing all these other things. And that's what sannyasa is. That's what renunciation is. And if my prarabdha, if my situation is not that, If I have responsibilities and obligations, I'm living an active life, then I live a life of karma yoga, and I do dharma. I do good. I do what is most harmonious in every situation. And often I do what it is that I need to be doing to support those that I love in the world, etc. This is upariti. Titiksha, the fourth quality, is offering no resistance to the world as it is. Sometimes it's referred to as accommodation, which is not a bad definition. I accommodate everything. But really, again, this is a point where if I get agitated because the world is not behaving according to my model of how it should behave so that I can be happy, that shows the lack of a titiksha. And if it's a matter of will, then that's my practice. That's my intention, to allow people to be as they are and to work through those feelings and work through those notions. I actually don't have anything at stake in the world. I really don't have to hang my happiness on any peg in the world. And when I see that, I can let people be as they are. There's this saying, sarvam sthane bhavati. Sarvam, everything bhavati is sthane, in its own place. I can allow everything to be in its own place. And when I allow everything, including the people that are dear to me in my life, if I can allow those people to be as they are, it grants them extraordinary freedom because I'm not imposing my judgment upon them. To the degree I impose my judgment upon somebody, I'm not seeing them, first of all, as they are, so I can't react to them in the most beneficial and nonviolent way. And secondly, I'm really not seeing them as a spirit, as a jiva, as an incarnated being, and I'm really not seeing the truth in them. So there's a great blessing to others if I can let them be as they are, and there's a greater blessing to myself because I am unhooked. I am, in a sense, in regard to this particular person, I am a sangha. I can allow them to be as they are, and I gain extraordinary quietude and extraordinary freedom by just letting people be as they are. So this is sort of the fulfillment of titiksha, of this fourth quality, often called accommodation, sometimes called forbearance. And I think that's when, you know, you run against really bad situations that you really don't want to exist, and so you have to forbear it. But really, it's a matter of inquiry as to where I've placed my happiness. Shraddha, it's the fifth one, is a trust, and a trust in the words of the guru and in the teaching. It's a suspension of disbelief. It's a willingness to put aside, as I mentioned long ago, our internal scaffolding of the model of how we think life is and how we think spirituality is, so that we can actually just hear what this teaching is. And then we can go and try to fit, you know, our previous worldview with this worldview. But if we're constantly trying to fit what Vedanta says in the larger scaffolding of how we've decided things already are, then we're very likely to miss the beauty and the depth and the freedom that this teaching can give us. So that Shraddha is an ability to say, okay, let me just listen with an open mind, and let me try to understand what this says, and then I can validate or I can invalidate it. But let me just understand what it says and what it says about me. Samadhanam is the last value. Samadhanam is ability to resolve the mind and to focus. So it's ability to focus on what it is I want to focus on in just a worldly sense. But here it means the ability to focus and listen, be attentive, and bring the mind back to the self, to have a contemplative disposition. Samadhanam is, it comes from the same roots and prefixes as samadhi, a resolution of the mind, a capacity to bring the mind again and again back to the truth of myself. It's developing a contemplative disposition. And the last of these qualities is mumukshutvam. Moktum icha, one for whom there is a desire for freedom. There's a desire for freedom because that's the fourth purushartha. We said that we pursue kama, desirable objects, experiences, vacations. We pursue artha, wealth and security. We pursue dharma, heaven. And those three purushartas don't solve the problem of me being a limited, wanting person. Moksha is the pursuit of the answer to this problem in a very direct way. Me trying to make myself happy by getting a time-bound, limited object that happens to fulfill a fancy, that is a very indirect means to try to come to a sense of at-homeness. Moksha is the pursuit to the answer to the fundamental universal human problem, wherein I can discover that I, as I am right now, am what I'm really seeking in all of these other pursuits. And when I see that clearly, when I understand that, when the first person personal pronoun, I, falls constantly on the truth of myself, on my very swarupa, on my very nature, and I can resolve that I thought into the truth of myself, that is moksha. And so this desire for moksha is called mumuksha, and one who desires moksha is called mumukshu, and the state of being one who desires moksha is called mumukshutvam. And this is the fourth qualification for one pursuing this knowledge. So what is tattva vivekaha? Because the teacher said, I'm going to be talking about tattva viveka, which is the means to moksha. And so the student asks, tattva vivekaha kaha, what is this tattva viveka? And he says something extraordinary. He says, this atma, what is this self? Atma is satyam, and everything else, sarvam anyat, everything other than that is mithya. This is an extraordinary statement, because it says basically that I am the only substantial thing here. Atma is the only existent thing here, and everything else is mithya. Mithya is that which has a dependent reality. Adhishtana ananyat, that which has a dependent reality. It is also sat asadbhyam anirvachaniyam. Mithya is that which cannot be said categorically to be real or unreal. So, for example, we talked about gold jewelry or clay pot. The pot cannot exist without the clay, and yet potness is not inherent in the clay. The clay existed before the pot came into being. The clay exists while the pot exists, and the clay exists even after the pot leaves, after the pot disappears. So what is the reality of the pot? The pot has a dependent reality. The pot is very useful for carrying water. A plate is very useful for eating dinner off of, and a clay cup is very useful for drinking water out of. But the truth of each of those is only clay. Particular name and form, a functionally useful name and form is a pot. A functionally useful name and form is a plate or is a cup. But they are not substantial. They are incidental, and they have a dependent reality. They can't be said to be real because they have a limited lifespan, whereas the clay has an unlimited lifespan, if you want to put it that way. The pot depends on the clay, and the pot cannot be said to be real because it comes and goes, but the clay remains. It can't be said to be trikalepi tishtati, which is a definition of sat, of satyam, of what actually exists in all three periods of time. So the clay existed before, during, and after the coming and going of the pot. And it can't be said to be completely unreal because, like the horns of a rabbit, they always say, or the son of a woman who's never had a child. It's not tucham, it's not completely unreal, and it's not real. And yet, it's functional, it has a vyavaharika satta, it has a transactional usefulness, something that is mithya, has a transactional usefulness, but its ontological status, the answer to whether it exists or not, is that it is not existent, and yet it is not non-existent. But it's useful. And the one thing to know is that when we experience the pot, really all we're experiencing is the clay. When I touch the pot, really what I'm touching is the clay. When I experience the pot, I'm experiencing the clay. the pot doesn't hide the clay. Something that is mithya doesn't hide satyam. In fact, something that is mithya, that is ontologically not independent from its substance, it doesn't hide its substance. The pot doesn't hide the clay. The dish doesn't hide the clay. The cup doesn't hide the clay. The ring doesn't hide the gold, if it's a gold ring. And the ring cannot exist without the gold. The pot cannot exist without the clay. So when he says here, this is a mind-blowing statement, Atma Satyam Taranyat Sarvam Mithya, when he says that the nature of I right now is Satyam, is the thing that exists. In Sanskrit, it's called the Vastu, the thing. Literally, Vastu means a thing. Brahman, Vastu, the thing is, the one thing that is the same as myself, and everything else is a dependent thing, is a dependent reality. Everything else is a pot to my clay. Everything else is a ring or a necklace to my gold. In other words, the entire creation depends upon me. And you think, okay, so now you've gone too far. I've wanted to come here with some shraddha, but what you're saying is crazy talk. You can't really be serious that everything depends upon me. How can I be the only thing? I am this person. I am this jiva. I go through my life. I'm born. I grow up. I exist. I grow old. I decay and I die. I have a beginning. I have an end. Who am I to be what it is you're saying here? Really, what does that mean? How do I quote unquote experience it? Right? There's all these questions and all these qualifications. So then the next statement he makes is again extraordinary because he asks the question, Atma kaha? Because if I take myself to be who I normally take myself to be, that statement does not make any sense. It's like the Mahavakya in the Upanishads, in the primary source texts. These Mahavakyas, these great sayings, are all equations wherein they say, you are that, and that is the cause of this entire creation. And you are that, you are the one thing that never goes away. And you are that, you are that one thing that is the cause of all your pleasant and joyful and blissful experiences. And you are the truth of every experience. That is the equation, tattvamasi. And here he's saying the same thing. Aham satyam, I am satyam, and everything else is mithya. Everything else is dependent upon me. Well, if I take myself to be who I normally take myself to be, John Smith walking down the road, you know, who has to go to a job and is late for an appointment and all these things that we do, all these qualities that we give ourselves, then certainly those statements don't make any sense. So that's where this Atma Viveka comes in. And he asks the questions, Atma Kaha, what is the nature of this self? And he gives this fourfold definition. He says, Stula Sukshma Karana Sharirat Vyatiriktaha, first definition. Panchakosha Atitaha, second definition. Avastatraya Sakshi, third definition. Satchidana Swarupaha, fourth definition. Stula Sukshma Karana Sharirat Vyatiriktaha, Panchakosha Atitaha San, Avastatraya Sakshi, Satchidananda Swarupaha San, Yas Tishtati Sa Atma. Yaha Tishtati, that which abides, that which remains, that which is, these four things, Saha Atma, that is the Atma. He's going to go into each of these in a lot more detail going forward, in a lot of detail. But I wanted to cover some of these again, just so we have the context of what it is he's saying here. It's actually a two-part definition, and the first part has three sentences, has three statements. The first part is what the Atma is not, who you are not. It says, you're not the gross body, you're not the subtle body, you're not the causal body. You're not these five sheaths, quote-unquote, these five layers. We'll go into this. You are not the waker, you are not the dreamer, you are not the sleeper. So in each of those, we're saying neti, 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 neti. We're not this, we're not this, we're not this, we're not this. Why do I have to say I'm not this gross physical body? The sukshma stula karana sharirat vyatiriktaha. Vyatiriktaha means separate. Separate from the sharira, the body. And we usually just think of the body as this physical body. This is called the stula sharira, this physical, tangible body. And in the next sentence, he's going to make this very clear as to what it is and its cause, its general cause, its specific cause, its attributes, its function. This body, he's going to go into a great deal about this. But just right now, at this level, the gross body, the subtle body, which has to do with our pranas, our karmendriyani, jnanendriyani, manas and buddhi, our mind, our emotions, our senses, our capacities to act, our memories, our vital forces are all part of this subtle individuality. And then the karana sharira, where we go when we go to sleep. When we go to sleep, we go into sort of a potential state, the seed form, wherein we don't know anything, but we seem to be very happy. And this is called the karana sharira, the causal body, not the casual body, the causal body. And these are all negations, I'm not this, and which is a very curious way to give a definition. Because if I wanted to say, okay, so what is this table? What is this table? Give me a definition of this table. I'm not going to say, well, this table's not an elephant, and this table is not the moon, and this table is not the river, because it does not pertain. We cannot completely define something just through negation, because we'd have to negate everything. And the reason why it doesn't make any sense for us to say this table is not an elephant, this table is not a river, the table is not the moon, is because we have no mistake. We've never mistaken this table for an elephant. But we do mistake ourselves. I do mistake myself for this body. I do mistake myself for this mind. I take myself to be this karya karana sankhata, this body-mind complex. And when I limit myself in my knowledge, because I don't know any differently, I can't blame myself for not taking myself to be anything other than this body and this mind, because I have no means of knowledge that would give me an inkling that I'm something more. Only because I commit this mistake that I need to say what I'm not. This body becomes the locus of a mistake. I cannot commit a mistake about something that's unknown, which is very important to know, because it means that myself, this Atma that it is pointing to in this extraordinary way that I am the truth of everything, is not unknown to me. I can only make a mistake about something that is within my experience. And I am within my experience because I am the experiencer of everything. I am the one who experiences everything. I'm always in my experience because it's always me that is the subject of an experience of this. I experience this. I experience that. I am always here to be the experiencer. Therefore, I am not separate from any experience. And because I'm always here, I'm always available to make a mistake about. I don't mistake that table's an elephant. I can mistake that I am this body. Because an elephant and table can be separate from each other. I don't see them in the same place. I always see myself. When I see my body, I always see myself. When I see my mind, I always see myself. So why does it matter? What does it matter if I take myself to be this body and this mind? And we'll go into this a lot more because it's just extraordinary to see this fact. This is not a belief. This is not something that I'm going to experience in some extraordinary moment of mystical quietude. You know, I'm not going to merge with myself, with the Atma, that is true. I need to see a fact that exists right now. And the lack of the knowledge of that fact, of the truth of myself, is the cause of samsara. Is this cause of samsara? The samsara is a life of trying to find the value of X in the equation I plus X equals happiness. I plus X equals security. I plus X equals whatever it is that we're trying to find in this world. That's a life of becoming, trying to become something more than I am. And the reason I try to become something more than I am by acquiring objects, by getting rid of objects, by acquiring experiences, by getting rid of experiences, by acquiring relationships, by getting rid of relationships. The reason I keep doing that to try to prop myself up through these all these impermanent means is because I do not understand aham satyam. I am truth. Everything else is mithya because I take myself to be this body-mind complex. And so when we inquire into the nature of who I am, this is the very beginning of that process. Am I this body? Am I this mind? Am I these five koshas, which we'll talk about? Am I the waker? Am I constrained by the waking experience? Am I constrained by the deep sleep experience? Am I constrained by the dream experience? And this samsara is dependent on me taking the non-self as myself. This life of striving to become something is based on the ignorance of myself. This ignorance of myself causes me to misidentify myself, to superimpose identities upon myself which I don't deserve, which are not true. And because I superimpose this limitedness, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm wanting, I'm ignorant, I'm needy, I'm not happy, I'm insecure. All these qualities, which are really qualities of the body, really qualities of our emotional subtle body, of our buddhi, of our ignorance, of our knowledge, if I superimpose those upon myself because I don't know the truth of myself, then I am propelled to go out and try to make that situation right. And that's called samsara. That's this constant striving to become something other than I am because I have this relationship, just like I'm walking down the road and I on the beach and I see silver. I go, there's a silver coin. That's a good thing. I'll get something I want. That's great. I go and it's just a shell. It's just a mother of pearl. It's just one of a million shells that are not worth anything. I go, oh, I was wrong that time, but next time, look, there's a mirage. Oops, that's water out there. Let me keep going towards that water. That's going to quench my thirst, and that mirage never materializes. Or, oh my goodness, there's a snake on the road. I'm so frightened. I'm so vulnerable. I'm going to die. And you don't realize that there's just a rope sitting there. Because of the absence of the knowledge of the shell and because of the absence of the knowledge of the rope, I think that there's something valuable out there, some shiny silver thing which will make me a happy person. And I project a snake on that rope because I don't know that rope, and therefore I need to push that away to make myself secure. And that is raga and dvesha. Raga and dvesha are my likes and dislikes. And likes and dislikes can be binding or not binding. They're binding if I really believe that shiny object is going to make me complete. They're binding if I think that I really have something at stake because of the presence of that rope snake. Those are binding raga and dvesha. And part of developing the qualities of heart and mind and intellect that we need to see this vision that I am the truth of everything is to make those binding ragas and dveshas, those binding likes and dislikes, into mere preferences. I can prefer to have a dosa for breakfast rather than idli. I can prefer to have a fettuccine rather than cappellini. But if I end up getting gnocchi or ravioli, or if I end up getting upma instead of idli or dosa, I'm fine. I can allow things to be as they are. I offer no resistance. Everything is grace. Everything is given. Everything is Ishvara. Everything I'm happy with, because I don't hang my happiness on something external. Like I mentioned, this Tattvabodha text does not give us the means to develop these qualities, viveka, vairagya, shatka, sampattihi, and mukshutvam, which put another way is this, the ability to manage these ragas and dveshas. And that's what the Gita is all about. The Gita is a Brahma Vidya Shastra. It talks about the knowledge of the truth, but it's also a Yoga Shastra. And it talks about what are the qualities that we want to develop and how do we go about developing them. so that we can more clearly see the true nature of myself. So this lack of an understanding of who I am is first addressed by the statements of who I am not. Because without the understanding of who I am not, I cannot clearly see who I am. And when I take myself to be something other than I am, then I'm constantly striving and I'm constantly drowning in this ocean of samsara, this ocean to try to become something else. So that's why we have this stula sukshma karana sharira. These first three statements, I'm not these three bodies, I'm not these five koshas, these five layers, and I'm the witness to the three states that I experience, which are the waking, the dreaming, and deep sleep, because that sets the context. I need to understand what those are so that I can really see who I am. So we have this, the three bodies, the sharira trayam, the stula, the gross body, the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, and the karana sharira. So that's three, plus the five layers, plus the three experiences. So what is that? Three plus five plus three. So I'm not 11 things, right? No, these are what are technically called prakriyas. These are methods of investigation, methods of unfoldment, and they overlap. So it's not like there's three bodies and five koshas, and therefore there's eight things. It's that this individuality can be summed up by this model of the three bodies, can also be summed up with the model of the five koshas, which can also be summed up by the three states of experience. So they're all really talking about the same thing. They're all differentiating the Atma from the Anatma, the self from the non-self. And there's three prakriyas, three models to discern the self from the non-self. There's a certain type of grass in India wherein there's a pith. There's a little center that you can pull out. And what we're trying to do is really pull out in our vision, in our knowledge, ourselves from these apparently covering layers. I've talked a little bit about the stula, sukshma, karana, sharira, what those are. And we'll go into those in much more detail going forward. At a high level, the five layers are the annamaya kosha, the food, the physical gross body. The annamaya kosha is the same as the stula sharira. There is the pranamaya kosha, manomaya kosha, vijnanamaya kosha. Really, it's the enlivening systems of the body, the pranas. It's the emotional experiences that we have, the mind. It's the intellectual experiences we have. That is the sukshma sharira. And it's also these three layers, these three koshas. And lastly, it is the karana sharira is the same as the anandamaya kosha. So these are just a different twist. Different Upanishads talk about these in a little different ways. And so they're all presented here in a very succinct and direct way. Lastly, I am the Sakshi. I am the Sakshi to the three states of experience, the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. And these can all be summed up as a method called Drik Drishya Vivekaha, or Atma Anatma Vivekaha. Drik means seer. Drishya means seen. Drish dhatu, the dhatu, the verbal root in Sanskrit, drish means to see. That's where we get the word darshana, to have darshan of something. To go, you know, when you go to a temple, you have darshan, or you have darshan of a holy man. You see them, you have a vision of them. That's where we get arsha drishti. Drishti means vision. So it means can also mean knowledge. Arsha drishti means the vision of the sages. Drik means a seer, a knower. Drishya means the thing to be seen, the thing to be known. So technically, this is a drik drishya vivekaha. So we know that I am not this physical body. How do I know that? How do I know that I'm not all these other things? It's based on the premise, and it's a beautiful, beautiful unfoldment. In fact, the first talk I heard of Pooja Swamiji, he did what is called a drik drishya vivekaha, discriminative analysis between the self and the non-self. And it really brings to light that this teaching is not aspirational or inspirational. It can be those. Until you see it, it can be purely inspirational and it could inspire you to aspire to this knowledge. But really, what Swamiji did the first time I saw him was that he just said, hey, take a look at this. Look at this. This is a fact. Everything you need right now is right here in this laboratory of your experience. You don't need to go out and buy other materials to mix them in the test tube of your spiritual practice. All you need to do is to see what's the truth of your experience right now. And the truth of your experience is that the seer, the drik, is different than the driksha. The seer is different than the seen. This is a common experience. I don't have the problem that I take myself to be this table. I have no identity with this table, but I do have a relationship. I do have a seer-seen relationship with that table, and I know that I'm not that table. I do know that I have a body, and as we've talked about before, this body is an object of my perception. The only way I know that there is a body here is through my five senses. Interesting meditation is to imagine each of the senses falling away. And how would I know that I have a body? I wouldn't. I have no idea if I didn't have any senses. This body is an object. It's a tangible object of my experience. I am the seer of all tangible objects. By tangible, I mean subject to sense perception. I am the subject. The body is the object. So too the thoughts and the pranas. I know that I'm hungry. I know that I'm thirsty. Those are objects of my experience. I'm the experiencer. Those are my experiences. I am the knower. That is the object of my knowledge. The problem is that I take myself to be this body so much that I take myself to be the attributes of this body as well. So you say, okay, well, you know, I have a body. What's the big deal? Well, the problem is that I take myself to have the attributes of being fat or tall or tired. I take myself to be the attributes of the pranas. I take myself to be the attributes of the mind and the intellect, right? I take myself to be ignorant. I know my ignorance. Even my ignorance is an object of my cognition. I know my knowledge. Do you know Chinese? No, I don't know Chinese. I didn't know that I didn't know Chinese until you brought it up, but now that you bring it up, no, I know fully well that I don't know Chinese. I know my ignorance, I know my knowledge, I know my emotions. My emotions feel so real, they feel so much me, I can't get rid of them when they're really strong. These strong desires, these reactions, this anger, this desire, this confusion, this anxiety about the future, this regret about the past, it all seems very real, and it all seems to be me, but I would not have those experiences of emotions if I were not the seer of those emotions. Those are the sukshma sharira. Those are all part of this subtle body. In the panchakosha model, these are all the manomaya kosha, the manas. Decisiveness, intellectual activity, 1 + 1 = 2. These are all functions of the intellect, of the buddhi. All internal experiences are objects of my knowledge. I have a subject-object relationship with them. And all of these prakriyas can be seen as utilizing this fundamental method based on the premise that there's a difference between the seer and the seen. And of course, the irony is that in the end, I shouldn't tell you this. Maybe I won't tell you this. Okay, I'll tell you this. In the end, that difference is dismissed, is blown out of the water. It's completely dismissed. But you need to first see, to see the truth of oneself, you need to see clearly that you are not this. And then we need to look at the reality of the this. So if the body is not me, let's look at the physical body. If I am not the physical body, because I know this, you know, like I've said before, we have this special relationship because the sense of touch permeates this body. And I can lift my hand. I don't need to lift my hand with my other hand. I can just lift my hand. I have these karmendriyani, these capacities to do stuff directly with this body. But my body is as much an object to you as it is to me. My body is as much an object to me as it is to you. You know this body through your senses. I know this body through my senses. but I take myself to be this body because I have this sense of touch going all through it and because I have a way to manipulate it without much problem. But if I am not this body, what is the truth of this body? If I am not this physical body, this subtle body, this causal body, what is the reality of these things which I've dismissed? Do we have a radical duality? Is there a me and a not me? In the end, we end up with me. We end up with just me, which he says in this sentence is Satchit Ananda Swarupaha. And then we need to bring back the statement Atma Satyam Tat Anyat Sarvam Mitya. Because once we know that the truth of who I am, Atma Satyam, I am truth, I am Satchit Ananda Swarupaha, then we can understand the reality of the world. And the reality of the world turns into mithya. The reality of the world is a dependent reality upon me. So there is no two. There is no duality. It's a radical advayam. It's a radical non-duality. But to get to that, we first have to take our common experience based on our pervasive notions that I am this body. And we have to see this again and again and again and again. We have to see this so clearly that what's called dehatma buddhi, deha means a body, atma is the self, buddhi is a notion. This notion that I am this stula sukshma karana sharira, this gross and subtle and causal body, is so pervasive that when I say I, where does the I land? The I always lands on this body. Somewhere along that continuum of the gross, subtle, and causal body, it always lands there. I'm hungry, I'm tall, I'm fat, I'm thirsty, I'm stupid, I'm smart, I'm pretty, I'm desirable, I'm undesirable, right? I'm lacking, I'm full, I'm in danger, I'm invincible. All these eyes, and I'm a father, I'm a mother, I'm a brother, I'm a sister, all these roles. I'm a Oakland Raider fan. I'm a San Diego Chargers fan. You know, there's a lot of identity around sports teams. There's a lot of identity around accomplishments. You know, I'm successful. I'm a failure. Around this body, we have this huge industry just telling us how inadequate we are so that they can sell us things. So that was your homework last week, if you remember. Not last week. Last class was to pay attention to where this eye lands, because it lands everywhere except to this point, because we don't know this yet. The last part of this sentence is Satchit Ananda Swarupaha. Satchit Ananda Swarupaha. Stula Sukshma Karana Shariraat Vyatiriktaha. I'm separate from these three bodies. Pancha Kosha Atitaha. I transcend these five koshas, these five layers, which are really 5 points of misidentification. Is the best way to look at this. 5 points of misidentification. The body, the mind, the pranas, the intellect, even our ananda, right? Our ignorance too. Avastatraya sakshi, I'm the witness to the three states of experience. And then he says, Satchit Ananda Swarupaha San, remaining as Satchit Ananda, that is the self. So once we dismiss neti, 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 we have the context created where I can make a positive statement about myself. All of those were negations. I can make a positive statement about myself. And in that statement, he says, Sat Chit Ananda Swarupaha. I am of the nature of existence. Aham Chit Swarupaha. My very truth, the essence of what I am when I say I, is consciousness. Consciousness is not an attribute which I enjoy. Consciousness is not an attribute of the body. The very truth myself is also sat. The very truth myself is also ananta, limitlessness. Starting very briefly at this chit, I am never not conscious. I am always conscious. There's two ways to look at consciousness. One is a materialistic way, and one is a quote-unquote spiritual way. So materialists might say that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of a material existence. It's a byproduct. Consciousness is not inherent to my nature. I am a physical being, and consciousness is a byproduct of this physical phenomenon. And when this physical body goes, consciousness goes. That's a materialist, because the fundamental thing that is material, and consciousness is just incidental. Spirit, if you will, is incidental. A spiritual perspective reverses that. A spiritual perspective says that the truth of me is consciousness, and consciousness awareness manifests through this physical material body. The consciousness which I am manifests, is reflected in this mind, is reflected in these senses, is reflected in this body. This body does not create consciousness. It is an upadhi. It is a vehicle, if you will, and a limiting adjunct, which has the capacity to reflect consciousness. In fact, you can look at it like this, that consciousness is reflected in the mind, and then in the senses, and then in the physical body. But it's not that the physical body is conscious. The consciousness, the awareness that we experience in this physical body through the senses, through the activity of the senses, is a borrowed one. Like I said in a previous class, it's like the moon. I am a conscious being like the sun. I shine as consciousness. The mind, the senses, the body, anubhati, like the moon, it shines after. It's a reflected consciousness because this body is inert. What he's going to say in this next sentence is the nature of this physical body is such that it is inert. It's made out of inert stuff. When I leave, when the sukshma sharira leaves this physical body no longer appears to be sentient. It's no longer reflecting consciousness when the subtle body goes. So this materialistic view actually has everything reversed because consciousness is manifest in this physical body, and it's fundamental. So we'll have to see in the next class, we will look much more closely at the Satchitananda Swarupa Atma, because this is really where the rubber hits the road. If we see that I am untouched and the very basis and yet distinct from these three bodies, from these five koshas, which we'll see in great detail, plus these three experiences, the three experiences of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. These are not separate from us, but I am not constrained by these. In other words, the waker is me, but I am not the waker. That ER, that ER, is consciousness. I give consciousness to the waking person, but the waking person goes to sleep. And I'm as much present in the dream as I am in the waking experience. I don't go away. I don't even go away in deep sleep. Because otherwise, how would I know that I slept? How would I know that I slept well? We all crave to go to sleep. We all enjoy going to sleep because it's so pleasant, even though we're completely ignorant in there. But I don't go away. I never go away. I never go away from my experience. I am never outside of my experience, and the one thing that never goes away is called Sat. Sat Chit. The one thing that never goes away is by definition called Sat, existence. Consciousness exists. I am existent consciousness, or I am conscious existence. And in fact, this consciousness and existence, which the Atma is, Satchitananda Swarupaha, and even this fullness, this Purnatvam, this limitlessness, which is Ananda, which I am, are not incidental to me. They're not my properties. They really are who I am right now. I am consciousness. I am existence, which is limitless. Everything that appears to limit me is an object of my perception. Everything that appears to limit me, the thing that makes me mortal, this body, is an object to me. The thing that makes me ignorant is this mind. It's an object to me. And their ontological status, their reality, is that they are mithya. They are not real. They are not unreal. They are completely dependent on satyam. Atma satyam tadanyat sarvam mithya. The self is truth, is real. Everything else has a dependent reality. And that everything else is the stula sharira, is the sukshma sharira, is the karana sharira, are these five koshas, is the waker, dreamer, and sleeper. All that is mithya. All that is dependent on me, and I am right now that existence, which is consciousness, which is that ananda, which I look for in all my samsaric activities, in all my sadly mistaken attempts to try to solve for that problem of I plus X equals happiness. It's a tragedy because that X can never be fulfilled. If you want to put a value for X, the only thing you can put I plus X equals everything I've always wanted, anything that Santa could possibly give me, the only value you could possibly put to X is I plus self-knowledge, which is just I, is Satchidananda, which is existence, which is consciousness, and which is Purnatvam, complete fullness. So we will see more of this next week. We'll take a deeper look into the Satchidananda Swarupaha, and we'll start with the details of what the Stula, Sukshma, and Karana Sharira are. So let's take just a couple of minutes to sit quietly. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho barahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate, purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vishishyate, Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishvarapramastu. Any thoughts, questions?
It'll take long time to absorb.
Just keep exposing yourself to this because this notion that we are limitless doesn't seem quite right. And this notion that we are limited just seems so natural. But really in the vision of the Shastra, it's completely reversed. You know, this idea that I am what it is I seek in every desirable situation and that I am right now available to appreciate in total. I don't need a new experience. I don't need a new object. I don't need to acquire something or get rid of something. The only thing I need to get rid of is ignorance. And that's why it's so interesting to look at where the eye lands, because I will be walking down the road and I'm so busy being the person walking down the road that I just get lost. It's like the vacuum. It's like I get sucked into the vacuum of my transactional reality. And if I sit a little bit and have a little quietude, and when I walk down the road, if I can see that the body is walking. Like Krishna says, the gunas act within the gunas. The gunas interact with each other. In other words, all this physical stuff interacts with this physical stuff. This body walks. This mind thinks. That's why I try to get it at this meditation. The prana breathes. The intellect does its intellectual activities. The manas does its emotional thing. And all of these things happen in the context of my awareness, which I am. So if I can find a way through exposure to this teaching, through clarifying this vision, and through a practice of nididhyasana, of meditation, if I can find a way to sit with this vision, with this knowledge, throughout the day, then I can train this ahankara to come back to myself rather than hooking it on all these other incidental attributes, which I take myself to be. So it does take some exposure, continued exposure to this teaching and being with it and being around people who have a similar interest. That helps too. There's lots of resources available online. I try to post these talks a few days after I give them. I'm currently looking for an ashram. Swamiji's told me, create an Arshadrishti ashram. So I'm in the process of looking just for a small little place. I don't have a place where I can hold classes in person. So I'm hoping that I can create that in the next month or two so that people can actually, in this San Diego area, actually have a place to come and study. It's easier to teach chanting in person than on the web. And to have classes and to build a satsang, have a community, have some bhajans, have a potluck, have a little temple, have a library. I think that'd be wonderful. I don't have any other interests. So I'm hoping in the next few weeks, couple months maybe.
What message do we have from Pujya Swamiji from the time you spent at the Gurukulam?
His body is aging, his mind is aging, but his spirit and his knowledge are just clean and pure, and he's just present to everything that's happening. He's present to the process of aging and sickness that he's experiencing. He never complains, and his playfulness, even in the midst of his physical discomfort, his eyes are going, his ears are going, he has trouble walking, but when you sit down with him, he's just completely present, and he's just as clear as can be. It's just amazing to watch a jnani age. Oh. So inspiring. We take, you know, as we get older, we take our aches and pains so seriously, and yes, we take all the world that doesn't turn out. My life didn't turn out the way I wanted it to, and I'm not getting what I want, and I'm not getting what I need, and there's all these excuses to be unhappy. And Swami just says, it's all Bhagawan, it's all Ishwara, it's all inevitable. We're all preparing for this. And to watch it unfold, my guru, it's heart-wrenching on one hand, but it's so enlightening, and it's so inspirational. And I just love him dearly. It's just amazing.
Thank you for sharing that.